I'm not afraid of an army of lions led by a sheep. I am afraid of an army of sheep led by a lion. This quote that history gives to Alexander the Great is exaggerating for sure, but it's telling us a good point. It's telling us that we can't underestimate the value of good leadership. And if we looked at our society, I don't think anyone would accuse us of underestimating the value of leadership. I'm taking some business classes in college now, and it seems like every single topic is about leadership. How do you manage different personalities? How do you run a company? How do you motivate people? It's all leadership, leadership, leadership. I even looked on my Chick-fil-A cup the other day, and it said, Chick-fil-A Leader Cast 2013. So even fast food companies are having seminars and bringing in leadership experts and trying to do everything they can to figure out what it means to lead. And personally, I don't know how I could open up with an intro about leadership and not talk about sports, because the coach is the leader of the team always. When you do well, your contract is extended. You do really well, you're in the Hall of Fame. They build you a statue. But as soon as the team starts to struggle, you're the first one out the door. And so today we'll talk about leadership too, but we're going to talk about it from a different perspective. In fact, we're going to go back to the 5th century BC in the Middle East, and we're going to talk about what it means to lead like Nehemiah. So you can go ahead and be opening up there if you want. To the book of Nehemiah. And before we do that, as we talk about leadership, I would hope that none of us would say, well, this lesson doesn't apply to me. I'm not a leader. I'm not in any special position. I'm not over a group of people. And, you know, maybe there's not that much I can take away. Because the reason I had that scripture read for us in Matthew chapter 5, talking about us being the lights of the world, is because what is a light in darkness if not a leader, if not a guide, if not something that points us in the way that we're supposed to be going? And so, as Christians, if we're lights and we're shining all around us, then we have to be leaders. We have to be showing the world something different and getting them to follow Christ, and not truly us. But before we can really jump into Nehemiah, I'm going to kind of refresh us and bring us up to speed on the book in case it's been a little while. Chapter 2 and verse 1 says that the events took place in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes of Persia. So Nehemiah is in the land where of captivity about 150 years after Judah had been taken captive. In 586, captivity was over. Judah had been disobedient. They had fallen. Their city of Jerusalem was taken. Their temple was destroyed. They were in bondage because they disobeyed God. A little while later, about 40 or 50 years later, Persia comes in and conquers Babylon, who had conquered Judah. So now, by default, Persia is the one who is in charge of the Jews. They are nicer to the Jews. Cyrus allows the Jews to go home if they want to. And so in 538, some Jews go home. Some, about 50,000, head back to the land of their fathers. But most stay in captivity. And so there is a group that works. They get a second temple done, even though it's not the same. They're trying to kind of rebuild. But as we all know, Nehemiah is faced with a problem. And that problem is that the city walls and the gates of Jerusalem are torn down. Let's look at chapter 1 and verse 3. While Nehemiah is in Persia, he has some messengers come to him. And they said to me, "The remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire." And then in the next verse it says, "As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven." Nehemiah has a very strong reaction when he hears that the walls are torn down. He mourns, he fasts, he's really taking it hard. And so what I've outlined right underneath there, when it talks about the trouble and shame in verse 3 that's associated with not having a wall, is the idea of trouble means, obviously, that they can't protect themselves. Without a city wall, any attacker can walk in and take the city like it's nothing special. The wall is defensive. But then you think about the shame that's also associated with not having a city wall. It means that the proud city of Judah, the capital, the holy city, was a laughingstock. That it wasn't worth defending. That it was in shambles. And that also, there was no way to keep it pure from foreigners. There was nothing special about it. There was no protection. So Nehemiah hears this, but he also runs into an even bigger problem. The nation's relationship with God is in as bad a state as the walls were. It's torn down. It's in shambles. They've drifted away slowly over time. That's why they're in captivity. And even the ones who have come back haven't remained faithful, though they're in the land where David and all the great Jews formerly lived. When we think about Nehemiah, he's in an interesting position as a leader. He might not be the first one you would think of. He's actually in Persia. He's not at home with the exiles, but rather he's serving in the court of King Artaxerxes. He's risen up through the social ranks all the way to the court of one of the most powerful men in the world. And so when he hears this news about his people and their suffering, he has a tough decision to make. Is he going to stay in the life of comfort and as the king's cupbearer, as a trusted assistant, or is he going to go and embark on this project and try to take up God's work? So we're going to go through four keys, what we can learn from Nehemiah, what we can learn from his leadership, and how we can apply it. And the first one is to recognize God as the source of my strength. So let's look into chapter 2. Nehemiah is now before King Artaxerxes, beginning in verse 1. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." So Nehemiah heard about the wall. He was sad, he was distraught, he was upset. But he tried his best to hide it before the king. He tried to act like it was just another day in the life and that everything was normal. But the king saw right through it. And he said, "You know, what's troubling you?" And Nehemiah, you can see him bracing himself, saying, "Oh, don't worry about me. Long live the king. Everything is fine." And he pauses for a second. Look back in verse 4. When the king says, "What are you requesting?" he stops to pray. He turns to God and he realizes that this is a big task. Remember Esther, another biblical character who was in the service of a Persian king? And remember the problem that she was going to have to go before the king? These Persian kings are rulers not like today's rulers. They're not presidents and prime ministers. No one is checking over their shoulder. No one is going to veto anything they have to say. If you make the king mad, your head can be gone just like that. That's the situation Esther found herself in, and now that's where Nehemiah finds himself. He has to make a request of the king that really is asking for quite a lot. "Hey, if you don't mind, I'm going to leave your service and I'm going to go to this land that's in captivity and I'm going to help a bunch of exiles. And oh, by the way, can you send me some building materials because I don't have a lot to work with?" That's boldness. That is a big task. That is leadership. And Nehemiah stops before he embarks on that and he says, "I can't do this on my own. I need to pray to God." And in that moment of crisis, when he just had a second, he looked to God, he asked him for help. And God was there for him. This isn't the only time we see this quality from Nehemiah. In chapter 4 and verse 15, Nehemiah talks about God was the one who frustrated the plans of our enemies. And in chapter 6 and verse 9, Nehemiah prays, "God, strengthen my hands." Over and over in the book, he says, "God, you're my source of strength. On my own, I can't do this big task that's been laid out. I have a lot to deal with, but you can help me. You can be the one who will truly lead through me." So after each key, we're going to take a second and think about putting it into practice in our own lives. How do we recognize God as a source of our strength? We may never be before an all-powerful ruler. In fact, I would think none of us will be. But we all have moments where we feel like the task that's been given us is just too much to handle. As I was racking my brain looking for an example, finals week was the first one that came to my mind. You know, you start filling out your week's calendar and you start budgeting that last week, when you're going to study and when your tests are, and it looks like the calendar's about to explode. If one more highlighter touches it, if one more thing is on it, and you realize you've only filled it out until Tuesday. You know, I mean, there are just times when the burden that's placed on us is so much that we don't know how we're going to keep going. That's where Nehemiah found himself. And so he stopped and he looked to God for help. Or I think about applying this concept when you're leading a family, which, you know, I don't have firsthand experience with, but I'm starting to understand it a little bit, I think. This past week, I went to my grandparents' house in Missouri, and I was around six of my little cousins from ages 13 on down. So I kind of have the advantage. I'm the cool kid, not really by my coolness, but just by me being older. And so, you know, we're sitting down to dinner, and once I put salad on my plate, then all the kids who I don't even think like salad put it on their plate. And when we're trying to think of something to do, my suggestion is a great suggestion, no matter what. You know, younger people and kids look to us as the examples. And so when we're leading a family, there's so much more influence than I had as the older cousin. Wherever the parents lead, the children will follow. They're setting the tone, and that is a scary task. That is a big task. And so that's an example of a time when we can turn to God and we can say, would you help me with this? Will you be my strength? Because that's a lot of leadership for me, and I need you right there beside me. It's the same kind of thing that God is talking about in Deuteronomy 6 when he tells parents to teach his words diligently. When you sit, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise, emphasizing God's principles, looking to God and letting him be the true leader. Because otherwise we're not going to be any better than those leadership experts we talked about. But if we let him be our strength, if he is the one we consult, if he's the one we listen to, we take advice from, and we spend time with, then we'll find us being effective leaders in his service. The second key, accept the blame and spread the praise. So we talked for just a minute about how Judah found themselves, where they found themselves. How were they in captivity? It was largely through a cycle of disobedience and non-repentance. Let's go to chapter 9 of the book of Nehemiah. In chapter 9, the Levites are talking to God. They're praying to him, and they're kind of rehashing their history for a while. We're going to jump into the middle of this, Nehemiah 9 in verse 30. It says, many years you, being God, you bore with them and warned them by your spirit through your prophets. Yet they would not give ear. Therefore, you gave them into the hand of the peoples of the land. Nevertheless, in your great mercies, you did not make an end of them or forsake them, for you are a gracious and merciful God. Who is to blame for the captivity that Judah finds itself in? Was it the wicked kings who had led the nation in idolatry and corruption, who had took them on the wrong path? Was it the foreigners who the people had intermarried with and who had turned the hearts away to idols? Was it the generation before Nehemiah and the predecessors and the ones who actually got them in captivity? After all, Nehemiah's generation, they already found themselves in exile. It couldn't really be their fault, right? Well, this is not the attitude at all we see from Nehemiah himself. Let's go back to the first chapter. In the first chapter, Nehemiah hears about the wall and he starts to pray to God. And we're going to pick up in the fifth verse there. And I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and rules that you commanded your servant Moses. You hear what Nehemiah says? We did it. Even I did it. From everything we know about Nehemiah, he was a really good guy. He was an example. He's someone we're still learning from today. But he realized that he wasn't flawless. He realized that to some extent, the situation and the blame for what had happened to Judah belonged with him and his family. And it belonged with everyone around him. And so he owns it. He begins with accountability. And that's where leadership has to begin. I accept what's going on. Now, the blame is partially mine. I have sinned. I'm imperfect. But let's work on it. And something amazing happens with this principle of accepting the blame. And that's that Nehemiah is imitated by the other leaders. Let's go to chapter 9 again. I know we're kind of crisscrossing through the book. But I want to go back to this prayer that the Levites pray. In chapter 9 and verse 33, the Levites say, yet you have been righteous in all that has come upon us. For you have dealt faithfully and we have acted wickedly. Our kings, our princes, our priests, and our fathers have not kept your law or paid attention to your commandments and your warnings that you gave them. Even in their own kingdom and amid your great goodness that you gave them and in the large and rich land that you set before them, they did not serve you or turn from their wicked works. Does that sound familiar? The Levites say, we did it. Our kings, our princes, our priests, us, we messed up. We are to be held accountable. They don't pass the blame to anyone else, though there are plenty of good candidates, so there's plenty of blame to go around. The Levites, the religious leaders, take their cue from the overall leader, Nehemiah, and they say, we are to blame. But the funny thing that happens, and you can see on the second half of this point, is that when good things happen, Nehemiah has the exact opposite response. Let's look at chapter 6, verses 15 and 16. This is right after the walls have been completed. Chapter 6, beginning in verse 15, says, "So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days, and when all our enemies heard of it, all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem, for they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God." Who built the wall, Nehemiah? God did. And also in chapter 4 and verse 6, it says, "So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." God, he gives credit to God. He gives credit to the people around him. You know, if I was Nehemiah, what I would have been tempted to do after I led that project, I'd talk about it. You know, I might act modest to you and say, "Oh, no, that wasn't me." But after a minute, you'd get to hear me say, "Yeah, I led the people through a lot of opposition. And yeah, 52 days, can you believe I did that?" Right? And you know, maybe like today's leaders, I might name the wall after myself and say, "Nehemiah's wall of the city of Jerusalem." I mean, I put in a lot of volunteer time, right? I gave up a really cushy job. I've done some great things. And yet that is not at all what we see from Nehemiah. The same man who owned his failures and who owned his sins spreads out when good things happen. And he gives it to everyone else. He attributes it to God. He attributes it to the people around him. He makes sure that everyone who is on his team felt valued and felt important. So when we think about applying this point, it's not that it's going to be too complex for any of us. It's not that we look at this on the screen behind me and we say, I don't get it. It's just that it's hard to do. It's unnatural. It takes a piece out of our pride. Instead of saying, "I did this," it's saying, "God did this." The only time I get to say, "I did this under this plan," is when I mess up. I only own my failures predominantly, and I say, "Yes, I'm imperfect, but I'd like your help anyways." When things go well, I say, "Thank you," and I look to other people and appreciate them. And this is something that we all can work on. This is something that I know I can work on. You know, when someone says, "Oh, you did a good job," I don't usually say, "Well, God was able to use me to do something," or "The people around me really did good work, and I was just there too." I usually say, "Thank you." You know, just not selfish and totally prideful on the surface, but not deflecting and not giving God the credit. If we want to be effective leaders, if we want to be examples, if we want to lead on the job or in school or at home, among the church, then what we have to do is accept our own failures and shortcomings and spread out the praise among those who are helping us out. The third key to leading like Nehemiah: listen to those who care. If you've been listening a couple times, we've talked about opposition that faced the wall. And if you know the story, you're familiar with the fact that two foreigners named Sanballat and Tobiah decided that Jerusalem was theirs and that it was not God's anymore. It was not the Jews. It was theirs, and no one else had any part in it. And so when the wall gets to be in progress, they start to heckle the workers. Chapter 4 and verse 2, he said in the presence of the brothers and of the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of heaps of rubbish and burned ones?" And Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." So it starts out with heckling and with saying, "You're never going to get this done. This is so weak and flimsy. Look at all the rubble around you. It's not happening." Planting those seeds of doubt, trying to get in there and influence them. And yet, by chapter 4 and verse 7, their tune has changed dramatically. See, at the end of the verse there, it says they're very angry. And then by verse 8, they're plotting to come and fight. So the opposition facing Nehemiah and his team had risen from insults to threat of a war almost immediately. And as you would imagine, the people around Nehemiah, all those Jews, are anxious. And they come to him in chapter 4 and verse 10, and they start to express their concerns. "Thus in Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Our enemies said, they will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. When the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, they will come up against us from every place where you may turn. Then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places, and I stationed the people and families with their swords, spears, and bows. When I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. In other words, they come to Nehemiah and they say, wow, this is hard. Do you see all the rubble? Do you see we've worked and it doesn't seem like we're having that much success? And oh, by the way, people are trying to come up and kill us from every side, as if our task wasn't enough already. And what Nehemiah does immediately is he listens to them and he makes a change. He sets them up. He readies them for war. He gives them swords and bows. He places them where the wall hasn't been rebuilt yet. And he says, trust in God. Remember our first point? We're trusting in God. And remember what you have to fight for. Remember that this is a noble cause. So he does something really good and something that's characteristic of the best leaders. He listens to criticism. He listens to critique. And he's willing to say, you know, maybe I'm in charge of this project. Maybe I'm the leader of this household. Maybe I'm in a position of authority. Or maybe I'm just an example. But I'm willing to listen to others who want to help me. And he responds, things go well, and of course the wall gets completed. What's interesting is the flip side of this point too. If we're listening to those who care, then by implication we are not listening to those who don't care. What was Nehemiah's response when they were saying that a fox would break down his wall? What was his response when they said, we're going to go to war? Well, you don't read about one, do you? He just puts his head down and says, you all aren't going to help me. You all are trying to tear me down. And I've just got to ignore you because I've got a task to do. I've got something important, and I can't listen to those who don't care. So when we're in that influential position, when we're an example, when we're a leader, when we're trying to bring people to Christ, and when we're different from the world, there's going to be a lot of people who think we're doing it backwards, who think we're using the wrong standard, who think that a biblically principled life and leadership based on something from thousands of years ago couldn't possibly work today. There's going to be people who will tear us down, and if you don't believe that, then you must not have been watching the same movies, TV shows, reading the same articles that I am. I mean, the Christian world we know and the Christian morals that we cling to, it's all under attack. And there are many people making a lot of noise that the Bible is doing it wrong, and for that, we need to have Nehemiah's attitude of, oh, well, I have a job to do. I have something bigger and better to focus on, and I'm not going to let that weigh me down. But when someone who cares about us, when a brother, when a sister, when someone who's older, when someone who is involved in the same work we are, when they come up to us, when they have feedback to offer, then it's time to listen. Then it's time to not get defensive anymore, to not rile our backs and not say, I got this, this is mine, you know. If you want me to lead, then take my leadership. No, you listen and you change and you're willing to be involved with your people. So let's do another personal story to illustrate this point, if you'll put up with that. In the ninth grade, I played rec basketball, and I'm not a very good basketball player now. I was quite a bit worse in the ninth grade, and so outside of run faster, I got a lot of other critiques from my coaches too, and the number one one is that I would get pulled aside, and I would get a hand placed on my shoulder, and my coach would say, Adam, I want you eating raw meat and gunpowder, which is to say, if you need a translation like I did, I want you to be aggressive and mean and nasty. And I want you to go get some rebounds, and I want you to not be gentle. Which takes some effort on my part. And so, at the beginning of the season, especially when I didn't have a rapport, I didn't know him, I just kind of would close down and think to myself, I don't need to listen to that. You know, I'm trying my best. That's stupid. I'm going to keep working. But later in the year, once I realized that, you know, he wasn't trying to pick on me. He wasn't trying to single me out. He just wanted me to be the best I could. If I would actually try harder, I would see good results. He would be satisfied. Everything would go better. And we see that sentiment in the Bible. That's not just from my stories. Ecclesiastes 4:13 says, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. Or in Acts chapter 5, when Gamaliel calms down the crowd that wanted to murder the apostles. We see a pattern of listening to advice and good things following. And that's another key to being a leader. Being willing to listen to those people who care about you and letting the noise in the background and letting criticism from those who are not on our side go in one ear and out the other. Fourth and final key to being a leader like Nehemiah is to recognize the value of one leader. Remember for a second where Jerusalem found itself at the beginning of the book. The walls were torn down. The people had drifted away from God. They were in trouble and shame. Remember, we're in danger and we're getting laughed at. There's not a combination that's much worse than that. The city had become a laughingstock. Foreigners had inhabited it. The relationship with God was decaying. And yet, one man stepped out from his comfortable position of the Persian king and being in his court, and he made a bold request. He went and he began to work, and he got great things done. The wall was done in 52 days, even in spite of all those threats we talked about, even in spite of the danger, even though at one point in the book, they have a sword in one hand and they're working on the wall with the other. Offense and defense at once. They have a lot on their plate, and yet things get done through Nehemiah. And in fact, we also see a turn to the law of Moses again. Ezra and the Levites read from the book in chapter 8, and the people are convicted. In fact, in chapter 8 and verse 9, it talks about Nehemiah, who was the governor, and Ezra, the priest and scribe, and the Levites taught the people, said to all the people, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep." For all the people wept as they heard the words of the law. They had gotten so far off and had come so far back that they were reduced to tears at what their condition had been, at how far away they'd been. And through Nehemiah's guidance and through the help of the other people, through the help of Ezra and the Levites, they were getting it turned around. In chapter 12, Nehemiah dedicates the wall, and in a way he dedicates the people. He puts the emphasis back on holiness, back on being set apart, back on being God's special people. And in chapter 13, like the scripture says up there, we have one more example from Nehemiah. He's returned to Persia. He's back working for the king. And yet he kind of pops in for a visit to check on the people. Chapter 13 and verse 6. "While this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went to the king. And after some time, I asked leave of the king and came to Jerusalem. And I then discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And I was very angry, and I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of the chamber. Then I gave orders, and they cleansed the chambers, and I brought back there the vessels of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense." If the name Tobiah rings a bell, it should. He is the one, along with Sanballat, who was opposing the wall most vehemently. And yet, by the time Nehemiah comes back, he's kind of got his stake back in Jerusalem, as he did at the beginning of the book. In fact, he is using the temple as his own personal room. Verse 8 tells us it's complete with household furniture. The house of God had been corrupted to a point where a man was using it as a storage shed. And Nehemiah was going to have no part of that. He gets so angry, he throws everything out. A cleansing of the temple, reminiscent of another cleansing of the temple. He is devoted to making sure the people are pure. His blood is boiling when he understands that things aren't right. And when the project that he just undertook had backfired, or at least slipped back, he doesn't let it be. He changes. And throughout this 13th chapter, we see that same pattern. In verse 10, he talks about, "I found out that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled each to his field. So I confronted the officials and said, 'Why is the house of God forsaken?' And I gathered them together and set them in their stations. Then all Judah brought the tithe of the grain, wine, and oil into the storehouses." Same kind of thing. The Levites weren't being taken care of like the people were obligated to do. They were supposed to let the Levites focus on religious duties, and yet they had to go out in their fields because they weren't being taken care of. Nehemiah, again, confronts, is angry, doesn't have any part of it. Do you see how much he's done for the people? Do you see how much Nehemiah has changed? He has not only helped them rebuild physically, he's helped them rebuild spiritually. He's helped them rebuild relationships. He has totally changed them. And of course, if Nehemiah were here today, he would give the credit to God, and rightly so. It's not all Nehemiah's power that changed everything. It was God through Nehemiah. But nonetheless, look at what one man did. Look at what an effective leader did to a people who were floundering, who were lost, who weren't getting anything done. I think we sell ourselves short sometimes. I think sometimes we say, "I'm not a leader. I'm not anything special. I can't change people. I can't be used to guide a family, to guide a church, to guide a workplace, to guide my school classmates in righteousness. That is too much for me." And it is, but that's why we turn to God. That's why we listen to those around us. That's why we're hard workers and why we're the kind of leaders that we need to be. This leadership is needed. Families need this leadership. Churches need this leadership. is not optional. Whenever good leadership isn't in place, things fall apart. And so we've got to step up and we've got to be the kind of leaders that we should be. And while we're talking about being leaders and while we're talking about the impact that one man can make, I think it's a good time to talk about Jesus for a moment. We've been in the Old Testament throughout this study, but when we think about what one man can do, who could come to mind sooner than Jesus? The perfect man, the one whose sacrifice we remembered just a moment ago, the one who is willing to die for us. Let's go to Romans chapter 5. It's a familiar passage, but I think it's still powerful. Talking in verse 6 beginning, "For while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare to die. But God shows his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since, therefore, we have now been justified by his blood, much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God. For if while we were enemies we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son, much more now that we're reconciled shall we be saved by his life." At the right time, Christ gave his life up, even though we didn't deserve it at all. And Paul goes on to say, if God was so good to us while we were his enemies, how good to us will he be once we can be his children, once we can be on his side? That's what the offer is today. That's what the invitation is. Let the one man change your life. Follow in the steps of a leader who is perfect, who doesn't have any blame to accept, and so he took on ours and he sacrificed for us. He willingly gave himself that we could live. If you know what to do and you know how to come into contact with the blood of Jesus through repentance and through confession of sin and through baptism, we'd love to help you out with that. If you have questions about that and that's something you want to know more about or you want to study with us, we would be happy to help with that too. Or if you just need our prayers and you have something you need to bring before the family and let us help you, we would be glad to do that too. Whatever you need, let us know while we stand and sing.